Hi, this is Ken McCarthy, and welcome to the Jazz on the Two podcast. We got a really, really interesting guest today. As a lot of you know, I just spent some time in Cuba, and when I got back, I got on the internet and YouTube and just went crazy, just digging deeper into what I experienced there. And one of the fascinating things I came up with is a project called Trade Winds by Matt Garrity. And we're going to be talking with him. He's taken his project all over Latin America, but we're going to focus on Cuba today. Welcome, Matt.
Good to be here, Ken. Thanks for having me.
Hey, how do people, since it's the beginning of the show, but I want people to know right away how to get in touch with you, how do people track your work? And then we'll repeat that at the end of the interview.
For sure. Well, the easiest way is to go to our website, mgp21.com, which houses all of the videos from New Orleans, from San Juan, and from the most recent leg, Havana, Cuba.
Great. So that's MGP?
Correct. As in 21.com, as in the Matt Garrity Project. MGP21.com, and there's about 80 videos as part of our ongoing video series up there. So that's the easiest way to check out the scope of our work.
Great. So Matt does this truly amazing thing that I admire a lot. Matt, you're a bass player and a producer, and he goes like to a place like New Orleans or San Juan or Cuba, and you give yourself, what, 21 days?
That's right.
Yeah, and every day he puts together and documents a different performance with local musicians. And you kind of arrive cold, or do you do any... I mean, obviously you know the music, but you're kind of putting it together as on the fly, right? At least that's what I got, the impression I got from watching the Cuba series.
Yeah, it's very much on the fly, and I have a team, a videographer, Laura Newman, and a producer, saxophonist, Zay Luiz from Brazil, and that's my core team, and the essence of it is that we show up to a town, in this case it's a city along the Triangle Trade Route, and form collectives of musicians in each one of those cities, creating improvised composition and work in the moment. So a lot of it's spontaneous, a lot of it is show up and scout talent on the ground, tell them about the project, the scope of the work, and that we're based out of New York City and where we're going, and really emphasize, let's create an improvised piece in the moment, and two rules, don't talk, just play. And we're very regimented on that front, and we've gotten some incredible results. It's really about listening and, you know, creating that improvised piece, and it really lets the ego to fall by the wayside. And if you get the right players in the right venue, you know, magic can happen.
I love it. I love it. Because, you know, some of the greatest music produced comes from just those kind of circumstances. Great musicians who can really listen to each other and really get into it, just get together and start doing something. And, you know, amazing stuff emerges. So you mentioned that you've been focusing on the trade route cities. And, of course, we've been talking to Jazz on the Tube listeners now for a while, emphasizing to them that even though Cuba has been cut off from New Orleans in the last 50-plus years, previous to that, Cuba and Havana were massive trading partners, both economically and culturally, musically. And, of course, San Juan, also on that route. And so you've done New Orleans, Cuba, and San Juan. Before we get into Cuba, I'm just curious, where's your next adventure?
Well, we are going to Brazil, to three coastal cities on the east coast of Brazil, Recife, Salvador, and Rio de Janeiro. And again, looking for those cities that have that African culture footprint, knowing that we're going the trade route backwards, and eventually, well, once we're done with Brazil, the next destination are going to be key cities along the west coast of Africa, Ghana, and places like Mali, Senegal, and really to kind of finish, you know, that route to tell a story of how those cities are connected through music and begin to demystify, you know, some of those same rhythms that are likely called different things from city to city, from country to country, and show how we got American music and show that thread that is consistent in terms of musical footprint and that those trade routes allowed to happen.
Wow. What a great undertaking. And you support this project with Kickstarter, is that right, or one of those services?
Yeah, we've done two Kickstarters, one for the San Juan and New Orleans leg, and then one for Cuba. And the great thing is, you know, the Kickstarter covers our, you know, accommodations, but the majority of that money goes into the hands of musicians on the ground. So it's really connecting, you know, our 200 backers in the U.S. and beyond to the means to support local music communities around the world. So it's really worked out nicely. So we've done those two Kickstarters, and it's been a good option for funding and rallying people who want to back the project and support it, you know, at the $10 level or $250 level. So it's been good for us, and we're on the cusp of launching, you know, our third Kickstarter for the Brazil.
That's great. We have a lot of generous subscribers and fans of Jazz on the Tube, and I really want to encourage everybody, definitely check out Matt's channel and keep an eye out for the next fundraising thing he does, because this is a great thing you're doing.
Thanks.
Of course, yeah, I mean, it's one of these ideas that's so great, you wonder why somebody didn't do it before. Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. It grew out of after being in New York City for about 10 years and playing the club circuit, you know, all Blue Note, Iridium, and with my own project, and really playing with a lot of different world music groups and beginning to see, like, hey, there's a Brazilian clique, there's a West African clique, there's an Indian clique. Why can't I start to bring, you know, some of those cliques together, and what would that project be? And that's when I came up with the idea to create 21 brand new bands in 21 days. And I actually did it in my apartment and invited about 40 musicians from all around the world, even if they were coming in to town, like from Portugal, like Marisa's band, the famous Fado singer, got to start day one with this was a day after their Carnegie Hall performance. And we filmed 21 days straight. And, you know, you put the word out to your network and beyond your network, and you realize that musicians are looking for something, you know, a little bit out of the box and out of the ordinary to do. So we, you know, it was a straight through and creating new collaborations and filming. And we did this beautiful finale where we featured a DJ from the West Coast and David Block and Danny Musengo, a great singer from the singer-songwriter scene in New York. And so we'll really look to mix and match personalities and do collaborations and stick with the same rules. Don't talk, just play. So it was really, that was the first project, which led to this idea of like, wow, if I could get 40 of like the top players, even like Grammy Award winning musicians like Mark Walker and Mino Sinelu to come and participate, how would I bring this on the road? And that's when I came up with the idea of, hey, let's see how we could reveal how we got American music and where, you know, those rhythmic influences and melodic influences came from, because ultimately, you know, it did come from, in a large part, Africa. So, you know, how can we do that in a smart way? And that's what led to Trade Winds. And it's been, you know, humbling. To date, we have 250, you know, premier musicians that are part of the series, and it's growing. And we have a Cuba release concert, CD release concert at Subrosa, the hot Cuban club on Gansevoort Street in Meatpacking District on May 4th. And that's going to be the same concept where I'm curating and creating 21 brand new bands in one evening, mixing, you know, great Cuban musicians with New Orleans musicians, Puerto Rican musicians, and musicians from New York City, and really trying to create fresh collaborations on the spot. So we're excited about that show.
Wow, can you put a ticket aside for me as a paying ticket? I don't want to miss that show. That's crazy. That sounds so amazing. Now, you started at New Orleans, right?
We started in New Orleans. I mean, I like to say that we started in New York because we did about four or five concerts at the Iridium where we refined this concept in one evening and filmed all of that. And then we used that as our jumping off point to go to New Orleans. And I know that we have a common connection, Chuck Perkins at Cafe Istanbul.
Yep.
And he was the first spot that we hooked up with and did some sessions and a concert there. And in New Orleans was such a vibrant scene, and we got to play with the likes of Johnny Vidakovic, Mario Abney, cats from the Rebirth brass band like Derek Tabb, and just really the city opened up to us.
Well, Chuck's a great gateway to New Orleans.
Yeah.
He's helped a lot of people do a lot of interesting projects down there. He's the narrator of a lot of great films about New Orleans. And yeah, Cafe Istanbul, if anybody's going down to New Orleans, definitely see what's going on at Cafe Istanbul. And if you see something you like, definitely go. It's a great space. It's also connected with a community healing center.
Yes.
Just really interesting, kind of one of the great positive things that came after the floods was the development of that.
Mm-hmm.
So you're kind of going back, and New York, of course, is the Big Apple, still is musically. You started there, and then back to an influence, surely a big influence on New York, New Orleans, and then from New Orleans going to the influences on New Orleans, one of them being Cuba, which we're going to get into in a second.
Sure.
And then back to Africa. So this is just amazing. So will there be like a CD, a DVD set of the whole series at some point, or how are you going to make this all available? I know it's online. You're giving it away for free, which is great. Appreciate it. But I hope there'll be something physical too.
Yeah. Yes. So yeah, the video series is online on mgp21.com for all to see the beautiful sights and sounds that were captured by our videographer and filmmaker, Laura Newman. And we're planning on a documentary that will connect all the dots of where we were and where we're going, and the stories of the musicians and struggles and their aspirations and dreams. And by the end of trade winds, so like I said, Brazil is next, and then key locations in the west coast of Africa, and likely ending with Cabo Verde, Cape Verde. So there will be a documentary, and we just also, as far as a product, just released the double Trade Winds Cuba CD, which features 21 tracks mastered with over 100 musicians. Much of the work, which is in the videos that are on that website. So, that's a product that CD is available on Amazon and iTunes for download. And so we're excited about that.
Great. Well, let's talk about Cuba, your third city in the series. But where do we begin to talk about Cuba? I'll just say to everybody, anybody that loves music, somehow by hook or crook, get yourself to Cuba. The sooner, the better. Cuba's been pretty much closed as long as I've been alive to American citizens. And I finally got down there this year, and wow, it's just such a revelation. I'm just going to throw out a statement you could comment on. There's probably more highly developed musicians in Cuba per capita than any other place on earth. 11 million people, and I think they definitely have a very good portion of amazing musicians down there.
Yeah, and a lot of that has to do with just how important music and ingrained it is in music education into their culture. A lot of the musicians that we worked with were originally classically trained. There's incredible piano players there, like Rolando Luna, and drummers. I mean, it's a world of drummers and piano players that are just exceptional. And it's that history that goes back so long, and the lineage and the language that is pretty profound, and I have a lot of respect for it, and it's a musical powerhouse, as you know from going there. And you know, you've got the scene in Havana, which, you know, a lot of musicians from, you know, other cities, other parts of Cuba flock there. So you have a very good, you know, representation of the diversity from, you know, the hip hop scene with Interactivo, Telmari, Roberto Caracases. But you also have, you know, some of like the Guantanamo musical styles like Shangui, and you've got the Afro-Cuban. So you really have a nice melting pot of, and you know, Afro-Cuban jazz in Havana itself. But then you go outside, and you could probably attest to this, you go outside of Havana and you realize that you just kind of like scratch the surface of
the
musical genres and depth in that country. And you really need quite a bit of time to delve into that.
Yeah, I don't think you could cover Cuban music in anything less than a lifetime of study. I mean, it's so deep and it's so vast. Just a little geographical thing that I didn't realize and kind of figured out. Cuba is wider. It's a big island, right? It's huge, and it's wider east-west than Florida is north-south. Anybody that's driven from the Georgia border to, you know, the tip of Florida knows that's a long drive. Well, the drive from east to west in Cuba is longer. So it is big, and as Matt said, there's music everywhere, in every town, in every village, and it's serious. It's deep. Well, one of the things that jumped out at me, and I want to highlight and get your comment, is you talked about classically trained. There doesn't seem to be these fixed, hard boundaries in Cuba when it comes to music. You can have a guy who is, you know, playing his classical gigs, and then he's playing his Latin, Afro-Cuban jazz gigs, and then maybe he's participating in a different way in rumbas.
Yes.
They seem a lot more fluid than we see in the United States.
Yeah, and I think that has to do with this idea that there is a blurring of the lines between music on the streets in the clubs and music in the educational institutions. Maybe in the U.S. there are exceptions, but there's more of a division between the jazz world and the classical world. Is it because of the educational institutions create that divide? That was one thing that I observed in Cuba, where it seemed like there was less of that division. So you could have the classically trained musician who improvised at a very high level. So there just seemed to be something worth investigating on that front. But in terms of your point on the openness of the music scenes and styles, people jumping from one style to next, I think that's well exemplified from the band that we worked with, Interactivo, which is the timba hip-hop jazz band, which is a really kind of a collective of excellent musicians, jazz musicians, funk musicians, hip-hop, that, you know, I think number maybe 15 to 20, but it's really, you know, if you're a member of Interactivo, you could, you know, leave and live in Europe for a few years and then come back to Havana and you're still part of Interactivo. And, you know, it crosses genre as well. And, you know, we had a chance to work with them at Egrem Studios, the original Egrem, and did a few sessions with a lot of those players. And, yeah, you sense that there's more fluidity, but, you know, there's always exceptions to that rule. I mean, I think musicians in 2016 recognize, you know, that they need to be familiar with a lot of different styles, but it's great to see in Cuba, you know, that's happening, and at a really, you know, talented level across the musicians that we worked with.
Beyond the classical side, my understanding is that, you know, Cuba had that relationship with the Soviet Union for so many years, and they put out a call because a lot of the conservatory level professors left the island, and so call was put out to Soviet Union and the Eastern, so-called Eastern Bloc countries, hey, come to Cuba. You know, tired of potatoes and drizzly weather all year? Come here. And a lot of them, a lot of really fine, fine classical pedagogues said, yeah, okay, we're coming.
Yeah.
So there's just a very, very high level of technical and classical training available to young musicians, and it shows in their playing. You know, their chops are fantastic.
It's very inspiring.
So when you now Cuba's a tricky place to do business because, you know, it's just a different kind of place. You know, it's not as, it's got its own style of organization. You know, let's take one example, the internet. There is internet in Cuba, but it is really, really limited, difficult to use, expensive. So it's one of the few countries on Earth where you can't just easily get stuff done via the internet. So talk about, I guess a lot of the stuff that went on, and maybe this happens in all your projects, was word of mouth. You started with one, you found a bass, someone to start with, and then that led to other musicians. Can you talk a little bit about that process, and specifically how it played out in Cuba?
For sure. So I think your comments on the challenges in Cuba for doing a project or like this, Trade Winds, are pretty perceptive. There is no internet that you could particularly rely on, and the use of cell phones is pretty sporadic and not necessarily reliable. It's you can't always rely on constant communications. But you know, what we did again was create 21 brand new bands in 21 days and gave ourselves just 3 weeks to do this. So, you know, we're certainly putting, you know, I think, you know, our necks on the line a little bit because we are having to deliver, you know, the work for our backers. And, you know, that work is the video series and a recording and, you know, documentation of our efforts there. So we showed up with one contact, Jorge Bringas, a very great bass player in New York City, who put us in touch with Rolando Luna, who's the piano player for Buena Vista. So Rolando came over. We showed him our, you know, some of our videos from New Orleans and San Juan and in New York, and he was really curious. And you know, we said we're here. And we're looking for musicians who, you know, would like to be part of our project. Here's you know, our vision for where we're going to create this series of work that shows, you know, how coastal cities are kind of the anchors and the hubs to the African musical footprint along the former trade routes. And I think, you know, once musicians hear the vision of where we're going with our work and where we've been, they flock to it. So we got, like I mentioned, a who's who of Cuban top talent. If it's, you know, it's, I could go on and on how many incredible musicians we're so honored to work with. And from Chucho Valdez's band to Perochin, the piano player, to Telmari, Rolando Luna, like I mentioned, and one musician after the next. And so I think musicians respond to, you know, when you put your neck out there and say, hey, we're doing this kind of forward-thinking, ambitious project. We have, you know, some money to pay you for your time, you know, a respectable, like, nominal fee. And, you know, are you free to do this? We'd love to book you and get this on the calendar for tomorrow or the next day, you know, at a studio, at a home studio, at different locations, and it's really word of mouth, right? And
yeah.
Your reputation's on the line too. You know, the trust in that musicians have in you to, you know, be professional and show up and also be able to play is, you know, it's key to it. And you know, I think, you know, having you know, I'm very fortunate to have the team of Laura Newman and Zay Luis. The three of us are very nimble and can deal with lots of different challenges and navigate, you know, cultural tricky situations and finances. So we're very focused on making this, you know, successful, smooth project when we're there on the ground. And it's a day-to-day effort. And per your point, a lot of it is word of mouth, meeting musicians on the street. Like, we met Don Pancho Terry, the incredible Shaker Ray player, just walking by a session that we were doing. And then there's a lot of serendipity that comes into putting yourself out, living in the moment like that, and creating, you know, a creative project and involving like a community of the best musicians in any given city. So it's been an incredible learning experience, just being able to bring people together and rally them around, you know, this particular vision of let's improvise a composition on the spot and break down some of the barriers around musical styles, because ultimately this project is not about style of music, it's getting musicians to play with their heart and create a meaningful work in the moment.
Who was your Spanish speaker or Spanish speakers on this project? Because that's a necessity in Cuba.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, I speak Spanish. I lived in Spain for a year, and also Zé Luis speaks Spanish as well, and of course Portuguese. So that's going to come in handy. I do speak some Portuguese as well, which will come in handy when we go to Brazil. So we make it work.
That's great. I speak a little Spanish, and nothing has inspired me so much to perfect my Spanish, or at least improve it, as spending some time in Cuba. I really want to be able to talk with the people there so much.
Right.
Hey, you mentioned that the legendary studio that you did some of your recordings in. Can you talk a little bit about it, its history, the fact that it's available for rental? You know, if somebody wants to do an interesting project, then you can get yourself to Cuba. This is an amazing historic place.
Yeah, that's right. Well, there are two Egrams, but the Egram studio initially that we recorded at, you know, is the archive, like, literally contains like the most extensive catalog of Cuban music in the world. So it's literally been around for forever. And we did several sessions there. And what I found interesting, if you go back to the Ry Cooder footage of him filming the Buena Vista Social Club there, you know, you realize that room has its own sound. And if you're really like a sound engineer / connoisseur, you can really kind of pick up on those nuances. But what I noticed is there's a creak in the floor that the videographer, when they're filming like Omar Portunda and those other incredible musicians, like there's a creak as they're moving around. And we have that same creak in our video shoot from that room. So I just think it's such an impressive room, just because you know the storied history of the countless Cuban legends that have performed and recorded in there. And I think it was just quite an experience to be part of that, and it was something else.
It's their version of the Sun Studios, right? I mean, it's the like ground zero for Cuban recording. That did you record upstairs in the quote old studio?
The biggest room we recorded in. So I think, yeah, that was upstairs.
Yeah,
when I remember.
Yeah, and it did a lot of wood.
a lot of wood.
And the board in there is a little bit on the old side. I mean, it's not state-of-the-art. And I heard a really interesting story about the Buena Vista Social Club. They recorded it they had an original recording concept when they first recorded it, but they had some other, they did other tracks and other microphones and other placements. And when they got back to the United States, because, you know, in those days you couldn't just hang out in Cuba endlessly, they realized they had a problem, you know, with the original recording. But they had these other microphone placements. So the challenge was, okay, we got to fix this thing. And they couldn't find a board that was that old in the United States.
Yeah.
But they initially couldn't. But they actually did a lot of research, and they found one in California's Central Valley. It was some sort of Christian music production facility that had this ancient board, and they were able to re-edit it. And that's why they got that amazing sound on that record, which I would
that's
say...
something else.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was a huge part of that record's success, and it just sounded so incredibly live. There's another funny story I just want to share, because I got to talk with guys that were very knowledgeable about that particular recording, is the original plan, you might find this interesting, was to take Cuban musicians and combine them with musicians from Mali. That was the original plan. And it's kind of a long story where that didn't happen, but basically at the last minute, somebody pulled the plug on the financing on the Mali side, so they just went Cuban only. Previous to that recording, the biggest record of traditional Cuban music in the States was a record called Cubanismo, or at least in recent times, because there were million sellers from Cuba before.
Mm-hmm.
And that only sold, I think, 150,000 copies. And, of course, Buena Vista Social Club sold 6 million. But a lot of people, because of that phenomenon, a lot of people associate the music in Buena Vista Social Club with, they think, well, that's Cuban music. And maybe you could comment on this. That is a flavor of Cuban music, but the palate in Cuba is unbelievable, like the number of different styles. And maybe you could talk a little bit about that and how you dealt with that in your project.
Yeah, I mean, I think we were certainly going for as much diversity as possible. And when we shaped the video series and the music series, the idea is that we want to represent stylistically across the board a lot of variety. So, yes, we wanted to hit on some of the traditional Cuban a la Buena Vista Social Club. And, I think that, per your point of it, with the Bri Cruders project almost being a mishap where they were unable to get the Malian musicians, but it turned into this huge opening for bringing, that collective of the Buena Vista's collective, globally, is just, a beautiful reminder that, when something goes wrong, potentially, maybe there's a seed of something beautiful that can grow out of it. So I think that's a fascinating story as an aside. But yeah, we tried to hook up with, like I mentioned, musicians across all genres, Changui, Negon, musicians from Guantanamo. We worked with street carnival bands in Bejucal and brought them together for the very first time. And that was like a small horn section and all like percussion. And we work with Afro-Cuban drummers and the hip-hop scene and then more of the jazz scene as well, and really tried to keep it as diverse as possible. And it was just great to jump from genre to genre and realize how diverse that music scene really is.
Yeah, I guess that's my point. It's an island, and it's, I think, 11 million people, give or take, and they've got more different kinds of music than a dog has fleas. I mean, it's just incredible. And it could take a lot of study, and I hope somebody does this. I hope somebody writes a simple, popular guide to the various musical styles in Cuba. And this is one of the things, one of the challenges for Cuban musicians is that, one, they have been cut off from the United States more or less for 50 years. They've certainly been commercially prejudiced. There's been prejudice against them commercially. Tell you a story, just unbelievable. One of the people in our group is a Afro-Cuban music collector, record collector, and he goes all over because these records are everywhere in Latin America. They're in Colombia, they're in Panama. By the way, Panama, he keeps raving, and this guy knows his music. He keeps raving about the music of Panama City, so just something to think about. I could put you in touch with him, by the way. But he was he often gets a lot of his records from radio stations, obscure ones. He'll be out in Dominican Republic or be out in some small town in Panama, and they're radio stations and they've got record collections. He found a classic Cuban disc. I can't remember what it was, but it was, a unicorn. I mean, one of the great finds. And the music director had scratched a line over it and wrote red on it so that it couldn't be played. And what's that all about? Well, what that's about is, just because of the political situation, there are a lot of business owners, media owners, that really had a bug up their ass about Cuba and did not want to in any way support Cuba its musicians, its products, anything. So Cuba's really had, the reason we don't know up here so much about Cuba is, you know, the embargo and then all the things that have come from that embargo, which include kind of a commercial embargo on Cuban music in many countries in Latin America, and certainly in Miami, believe it or not. You know, if you're a Cuban, if you're a Cuban who's made it to America and has become an American citizen, all is well. But if you're a Cuban still in Cuba, not so easy. Not so easy to get airplay. So a lot of the names that you mentioned in the interview, these guys are amazing musicians, but they just may not be known at all in the United States. And I'm hoping that's something that will change. I mean, one of the things at Jazz in the Tube, we're in active search of a Cuban music correspondent. We've got kind of one in Tokyo. Your friend James Catchpole is a buddy of ours, and he does little things. You know, he's put together a Tokyo jazz list. Yeah, but we're looking for like someone that would do a column every week, you know, just exposing this music to our listeners, because again, there's just tremendous talent down there. Talking about, I don't know if you got a feeling for this, but talking about repression and the repression of music, there was a really interesting clip that you have in your series where you guys are basically doing a rumba, a really classic rumba, because you don't even have drums, and we're going to talk about that in a second, on the tabletop. And at some point, a security guy comes in, and he's not happy. And the last bit of that episode is he wants to see people's IDs. Yeah. And something that our listeners may not know, and this is shocking, but drumming, we know it was banned in North America, and one of the only places where drumming really occurred was in Congo Square in New Orleans, but it was banned for long stretches of time in Cuba itself. It was illegal to play hand drums in public or even in private. We went to a place in the countryside, I think it was in Guinness. Fascinating. They had made chairs that were actually drums. In other words, if you hit the side, I'll send you pictures of them if you like. And what would happen is the cops, you know, they'd hear drumming, and the cops would go out because it was a jailable offense to be playing the drums. And they would break into the house, and there would just be a bunch of guys sitting around, and like, no drums here, boss. And it worked, apparently. So I don't know where I'm going with this, but it was just funny that you included that clip, because it's kind of a reminder that this music survived incredibly harsh conditions. I don't know where we can go with this, but I think this is something that people need to know.
Yeah, I think it's the point that I'd like to make is when you look at the professions that allow Cubans to leave and get out of the country and tour the world and even maybe move somewhere else, music is right up there as number one, probably next to, you know, being a doctor. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, as much as probably musicians have maybe struggled there, it's also a very respectable career that can let you move to the U.S., let you move to other countries and get out of Cuba if that's what you're seeking. So just its place in society in that sense, I think, you know, is a nice contrast to think about from other countries in the U.S. But there are a lot of great Cuban musicians in New York already, a couple of them that we've met in Havana and have since moved here. But I think, you know, going back to your earlier point of where we orient trade winds, is that, you know, even though there are those political issues and, you know, with Obama being there just a few weeks ago, you know, the great thing about trade winds is that it has nothing to do with politics. It's bringing together Cuban musicians in new ways, and Cuban musicians with American musicians and Brazilian musicians. And we hope to, you know, for the May 4th concert at Subrosa, bring Cuban musicians from Havana that we worked with. And we want to shed light on the fact that the beautiful thing about trade winds and where we're going is it's bringing people together, and it's not about divisive, you know, politics and differences. It's finding those commonalities that we as American musicians and Cuban musicians share, and we find mutual ground to collaborate and work, and that's via art and music and film, and we get to showcase those musicians, those 100 musicians that we filmed over the course of 21 days in our video series, to a much wider audience, hopefully, that they would not have been exposed to before. So that, at the end of the day, is one of the main goals of TradeWinds. Is like, so that's why we wanted to go to Cuba, because we knew that there was a huge opportunity there to put the spotlight on the incredible talent in that island, and continue to build our collective and show that we're all connected in that way.
Well, music has always been a beacon for bringing people together across lines, in spite of whatever political craziness is going on. I mean, there's always some political craziness going on somewhere throughout history. The worst of which, of course, was the trade in enslaved human beings, and the fact that not only the people survived this really Holocaust. I mean, there's no other way to describe it. But the culture survived vividly. I mean, very strongly. It's just a testament to music's power. And of course, how Cuba is something people just really aren't aware of. You know, Cuba is not just, okay, well, that's Cuban music, and there's Puerto Rican music, and there's music from Trinidad, and it's all different. No, Cuba is like the great, I don't know how to describe it, but the great, almost like Atlantis, you know, in the sense that it created so many ways of playing music that disseminated throughout the Gulf Coast and throughout the Caribbean and even Africa. But I don't think people are aware of how many African pop styles actually had their roots in Cuban styles, because Cuba was one of the first places to get recorded and have their records sent out to the world. In fact, Cuban music was recorded a few decades before the first jazz record. So anyway, Cuba, so not only, so music in general has provided a great barrier busting force, but Cuba in particular, I think, has really done that to a degree that the average person, even music lover, even knowledgeable, just doesn't appreciate. And we hope that's going to change, and I know it will change with time. Hey, as we're wrapping this up, can you give some tips based on your 21 days? Let's say somebody's listening to this and they're going, oh my God, this sounds great, I got to get to Cuba. Just some practical advice on, you know, how to get the most from their time in Cuba, whether they're going for a few days or a few weeks.
Yeah, sure. Well, it's getting easier to fly there, and I think soon there will be direct flights maybe out of New York, but now there's chartered flights out of Florida. So once you get there, you know, I think if you're into the music scene, you know, you want to go to those locales maybe that aren't like tourist central. The places like Fábrica del Arte is a epicenter for everything music and art in Havana. That's a must. And just to track down the schedule of some of the artists like Interactivo, that band, and you check some of the artists in our 21 series and ideally see where they're performing. And you know, I think it's, in my opinion, I don't think Cuba's going to open up as quickly, you know, to Starbucks and McDonald's and the Hiltons as a lot of people think. I think it may be slow to change, but there are some logistical things, you know, that are, you know, you just need to keep in mind, likely, and just in terms of like knowing that, just be prepared to be off the grid. Even though there is some internet there, you really are pretty much cut off. And, you know, Airbnb was a great option for us for finding lodging. And, you know, probably rent a cell phone. It's not inexpensive there, surprisingly, as an American. You know, the exchange rates you'll find are pretty high and not advantageous. So there's things like that. But highly recommended if you could get down there to make it a point and explore Havana and get beyond Havana. I understand there's like 7 other airports in Cuba, so there's a lot of territory to explore, and doesn't hurt to find, you know, a guide that could bring you around so that you make the most of your time. We had a couple great musicians helping us, pointing us in the right direction. So that's just a few tips.
It's by the way, people that think they can go to Cuba and then easily get from city to city probably need a warning. It's not like there's a Greyhound bus terminal or a train if you want to go. Well, there is a train if you want to go to Matanzas, but it's just hard to get from city to city, and finding a good driver would be a really key resource with a good
That's
car.
Right. That's right.
Great, yeah. I just encourage everyone to go. It's the weather is, you know, it's like Miami in the summer, so if that's hot, it's going to be hot. But I say from November to March, you've got really nice weather, dry, doesn't rain too much. I'm not a lawyer, but CNN just came out with an article that basically said the old restrictions have been lifted. In other words, you don't need to go through a formal application process anymore. It's now on the honor system, and if you can, you better save your records for 5 years, apparently. But whereas before you had to actually apply, I guess, to the Treasury Department and show how you qualify under one of the 12 or 15 categories, now you can just say, well, I'm going for journalistic purposes, or I'm going for people-to-people purposes, and that's
right.
It. And you can do a charter from Miami, or you can go to a place like Mexico City or Jamaica or Toronto and just fly direct on a regular plane. You do need a visa. And if you're flying from outside of the United States, I believe you can get the visa at the airport. But these are all things to check out. But it definitely, something has been lifted. Let me ask you this, because it's a practical question. The Airbnb experience, I assume did you book your Airbnbs before you went down, or did you book them when you were down there? It's just, and the reason I ask that, it's just hard to use computers down there or internet.
We booked it before we left.
Great. And pretty good quality. I mean, you know, we're talking about Latin America, which if someone's never been out of the United States or never been to Latin America, it's different. You know, it's just different. And a lot of what people experience in Cuba, some of it's Cuban, but a lot of it's just Latin American. It's just, you know, it's a different economy. It's a different way of
right.
being. But
right.
pretty decent accommodations through Airbnb.
Yeah. I mean, just like any other Airbnb situation, you want to go off of the reviews and make a choice that way. But we had a good situation and stayed in the same apartment for 3 weeks and did all of our, used that as our home base for our project. So it worked out great.
Great, great. So so lodgings are available, you know, food, plenty of restaurants to eat. Intercity transportation, a little tricky, so you need to scout some resources. But music pretty much everywhere. There's a great jazz club, and I don't know enough Spanish to give the Spanish name, but I think it's the Fox and the, I don't know, Fox and the Goat or something, and it's just right down from the Havana Libre, the old Hilton. It's just a block or two away. It's a basement club, and it's rocking. I mean, they've got some amazing musicians there. So if you're a jazz fan, that's a very reliable place to stick your toe in the water. Well, Matt, thank you so much for this time.
Thanks a lot, Ken.
Yeah, and I want to encourage everybody very strongly, go to M as in Mary, G as in gold, P as in Peter, 21.com. Check out the videos. Check out the site. You're going to love everything on it. It's fascinating. It's absolutely fascinating.
Thanks, Ken.
Yeah. Oh, man. I really appreciate it.
You know,
the work speaks for itself. And keep an eye out for the Brazilian trip fundraiser, because, well, once you see the work, you're going to say, yeah, this deserves support. And, wow, the Africa trips. Wow, that's going to be incredible.
Yeah, so it's all going to be, we'll be plugging those efforts on the website, mgp21.com, and also you can get information about our Wednesday, May 4th show at Subrosa in New York City. It's the Tradewinds Returns Cuba, Brazil, and Beyond CD release show, and the show is at 7:30 and 9:30, and that's 63 Ganzebort Street, and you could get some additional information on the website about that Cuba show. So it's going to feature a who's who of New York City Cuba talent. And that's Wednesday, May 4th.
Wow. And Subrosa is not huge. It will fill up fast. And I think as soon as people get wind of the show, it's probably going to sell out pretty quick. So if you're listening to this, Subrosa, I believe Subrosa is owned by the same people that own Blue Note.
I believe so.
Yeah. So And it's beautiful, beautiful club, beautiful. It's in the old meatpacking district, way west. It's in a basement, but nice, really, really nice. And not only should you get tickets now, but get there early so you get a good seat, because there are some amazing seats there. We write up on the music. Well, Matt, thanks so much for giving us an hour of your time and explaining some of what you did. And thanks for this work, really, really important work, and I wish you, continuing success with it.
Thank you a lot, Ken, and I appreciate the opportunity to chat with you, and have a great one. I thank you so much.
Great. So this is Ken McCarthy. I've been speaking with Matt Garrity. His website is mgp21.com. Check it out.